TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
A Question of Survival. Noam Chomsky's lecture on the current nuclear danger at the University College Dublin, Ireland, in January 2006. Professor Noam Chomsky repeated the urgent appeal to end all war that was first issued by Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein half a century ago. In part one of this one-hour lecture, Chomsky spoke about the nuclear threat that has existed ever since these weapons were built and reminded his audience that today, after the end of the Cold War, nuclear weapons are still pointed at every major U.S. and Russian city, ready to be launched in minutes. Against the background of this terrible reality, the U.S. is withdrawing from all major treaties limiting nuclear proliferation while actively building so-called usable nuclear weapons. In this part of his speech, Noam Chomsky talks about the threat from accidental or terrorist use of these weapons that are now so widely dispersed across the planet.
Nuclear weapons may sooner or later fall into the hands of terrorist groups. And those prospects are also being advanced by Bush administration planners and their British counterparts. Their aggressive militarism has not only led Russia to significantly expand its offensive capacities, it soon have the same effect on China, but it's also inducing the Russians to transfer nuclear weapons constantly across Russia's vast territory to counter mounting U.S. threats from every side. Washington planners are also surely aware that Chechen rebels who had already stolen radioactive materials from nuclear waste plants and power stations, but that they have also been casing the railway systems and special trains designed for shipping nuclear weapons across Russia. That's quoting Harvard University strategic analyst Graham Allison. Bruce Blair, former Minuteman officer, director of the Center for Defense Information in Washington, he estimates that every day many hundreds of Russian nuclear weapons are moving across the countryside. And theft of one nuclear bomb, he says, could spell eventual disaster for an American city. But this is not the worst-case scenario stemming from this nuclear gamesmanship. More ominously, he concludes, the seizure of a ready-to-fire strategic long-range nuclear missile or a group of missiles could be apocalyptic for entire nations. And all of this is imminent. Could happen tomorrow. Another major threat is that terrorist hackers might break into military communication networks and transmit launch orders for missiles armed with hundreds of nuclear weapons. And that's no fantasy. The Pentagon learned that a few years ago when serious defects were discovered in its own safeguards, which are much more advanced than those of the Russians, that required new instructions to be constructed for Trident submarine launch crews. Systems in other countries, particularly the recent proliferators, are much less reliable. All of that creates what Blair calls an accident waiting to happen, an accident that could be apocalyptic. These dangers are consciously being escalated, consciously, by the threat and use of violence, which, as long predicted, is stimulating nuclear proliferation, along with the jihadi terrorism that traces back to the Reagan administration programs to organize, train, and arm radical Islamists, not for the defense of Afghanistan, as proclaimed, but for the usual and ugly reasons of state, which had grave consequences for the tormented people of Afghanistan, and also for Pakistanis and the world, as the Reagan administration cheerfully tolerated Pakistan's slide towards radical Islamist extremism under the rule of Zia-ul-Huq, who was one of the many brutal dictators supported by Washington and London in the 1980s. It's pretty much the present incumbents. Reagan and associates looked away politely while their ally was developing nuclear weapons. The Reagan administration annually endorsed the pretense that Pakistan was not doing so. Well, McGuire writes further that under current policies, a nuclear exchange is ultimately inevitable. If present tendencies persist, we are virtually certain to see a return to nuclear arms racing involving intercontinental ballistic missiles and space-based assets, reactivating the danger of inadvertent nuclear war with a probability that will be extremely high. These, incidentally, are almost random samples from the general strategic analysis literature. As a step towards reducing the danger, McGuire urges Britain, his own country, to abandon its useless nuclear weapons, which he calls the lace curtains of our political poverty. But the crucial choices, everyone knows, are in Washington, or more properly, in the public arena, if the critical failures of contemporary Western democracy can be overcome. McGuire's immediate concern in this article I've been quoting in the Royal Institute Journal, his immediate concern was the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the May 2005 five-year review conference. The Non-Proliferation Treaty was based on two, it was a bargain, it was based on two central agreements. Non-nuclear states would renounce the option of acquiring nuclear weapons, and they were promised in return, first, unimpeded access to nuclear energy for non-military use, and second, progress on total nuclear disarmament by the nuclear weapons states. At the May 2005 conference, Washington's goal was to rescind both promises. That stand naturally reinforces what McGuire calls the cynical view that whatever the original intentions, the Non-Proliferation Treaty is now a convenient instrument of U.S. foreign policy. Washington's main demand, and that is on the front pages now, has to do with Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Washington wants it revised and restricted. And there's a good case that can be made for that. They're right, I agree with them. Article 4 grants non-nuclear states the right to produce fuel for reactors. Now, that made good sense in 1970. That's when the NPT came into force. But since then, there's been a lot of technological advance. And it, with contemporary technology, fuel for reactors is just a bare step away from nuclear weapons. So it makes sense to modify and restrict Article 4. However, any such restriction of Article 4 has to include and guarantee the same unimpeded access for non-military use in accordance with the initial bargain. And there are proposals how to do that. A reasonable proposal was put forth by Mohammed El-Baradei, who's the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, he's the 2005 Nobel Peace Laureate. His proposal several years ago is that all production and processing of weapons usable material be restricted exclusively to facilities under multinational control, accompanied above all by an assurance that legitimate would-be users would get their supplies for nuclear energy. And that, he says, should be the first step towards fully implementing a 1993 UN resolution calling for a fissile material cutoff treaty, informally called FISBAN, banning fissile material production, a treaty that would cap and make public all inventories of fissile materials still available, then leading on to the promised total disarmament. Well, El-Baradei's proposal was quite reasonable, and it would take a long step towards preserving the species, but it was regrettably dead in the water. The U.S. political leadership, surely in its current stance or any alternative on the horizon, would never agree to abrogate its unique exemption from international law and treaty obligations. So Washington's call for restricting Article 4 with regard to Iran is therefore regarded by most of the world quite rationally as just the cynical intention to convert the NPT into a convenient instrument of U.S. foreign policy. Now, U.S. specialists have proposed other proposals, advanced other proposals. Some of them are quite detailed. I'm not going to review them. But they all have one fundamental flaw. They require faith in Washington's benign intentions. And evidently, that's not going to go anywhere outside of Washington and 10 Downing Street. Media coverage of the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference in May was very scanty in the United States. It kept very much to Washington's agenda. So as the conference opened, the New York Times reported that the conference was meant to offer hope of closing huge loopholes in the treaty, which the United States says Iran and North Korea have exploited to pursue nuclear weapons. That's referring to Article 4. So in brief, Washington's agenda, not shared by the world, nor shared by prominent strategic analysts. The news report on the opening sessions focused almost entirely on Washington's demand that Iran dismantle all the equipment and facilities, I'm quoting now, and the quotation's interesting, dismantle all the equipment and facilities it has built during the past two decades to manufacture nuclear material. Both American officials have said that they were concerned that as Iran's June elections draw nearer, a politically popular drive to restart the nuclear program may accelerate. Well, that's an interesting wording if you think about it. Notice first the casual recognition of the Bush administration's fear of democracy, hence the urgency to nullify expression of Iranian popular will. But more interesting than that is the interesting phrase, the past two decades. Why are they concerned about the past two decades? Well, the selected time span since 1979 avoids an uncomfortable fact, namely that the policies that Washington now condemns are the very same policies that the U.S. supported before the 1979 overthrow of the Shah. That's the tyrant who was imposed by the United States and Britain in a military coup in 1953 that destroyed parliamentary democracy in Iran, overthrown in 1979. So today the standard claim is that Iran has no need for nuclear power, so it must be pursuing a secret weapons program. Quote Henry Kissinger, for an oil producer such as Iran, nuclear energy is a wasteful use of resources. That's Henry Kissinger today. When the Shah was in charge, and Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State, he declared that introduction of nuclear power will both provide for the growing needs of Iran's economy and free remaining oil reserves for export or conversion to petrochemicals. And the U.S. acted to accelerate those efforts, with Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, and others playing a significant role. Asked about his reversal, Kissinger responded with his usual engaging frankness. He said, well, then they were an allied country, and therefore they had a genuine need for nuclear energy pre-1979, but now they have no such need because they're an enemy. Washington's charges about an Iranian nuclear program may for once be accurate. As many analysts have observed, it would be remarkable if they were not. It was predicted by strategic analysts that the U.S.-UK invasion of Iraq would increase not only terror, but also nuclear proliferation, as indeed happened, confirmed by intelligence agencies in both cases. Reviewing these conclusions, one of Israel's leading military historians, Martin von Krefeld, writes that after the invasion of Iraq, had the Iranians not tried to build nuclear weapons, they would be crazy. Washington has gone out of its way to instruct Iran on the need for a powerful deterrent, not only by invading Iraq, but also by strengthening the offensive forces of its Israeli client, which already has hundreds of nuclear weapons, and though a small country, it's an offshoot of the United States, hence it has air and armored forces, which are larger and technologically more advanced than any NATO power outside the United States. Furthermore, to make the warning more stark, since early 2004, Israel has been receiving the largest shipment in its history of advanced U.S. jet bombers, very publicly advertised as capable of bombing Iran and equipped with unspecified special weaponry, as they're called, and deep penetration bombs, all of this intended for the ears of Iranian intelligence who are to make the worst case analysis. Well, Iran has options. It may abandon any hope that Europe could follow an independent and honorable path, just too subservient to the United States, and it may turn to the East, which is perfectly possible. China is one country that can't be intimidated. That's why the United States is so frightened of China. It's not like Europe. Europe backs down when there are any pressures. China doesn't, continues. In fact, Chinese trade relations with Iran are increasing while Europe, under U.S. pressure, is backing off, selling, it's receiving oil from Iran. China is also increasing its relations, extending its relations with Saudi Arabia, both military and trade. The U.S. would love to block it, but it can't intimidate China. Iran might decide to join the Asian energy security grid, based primarily on China and Russia, but with India and Japan and South Korea probably joining, which is an effort to form an independent system for securing energy resources for the fastest-growing economic region in the world. If Iran joins it, it becomes sort of its linchpin. Iran is being pressed in that direction, may very well move in that direction. There are developments in Iraq which are also proceeding in directions very threatening to U.S. power interests. There's a lot of talk these days about withdrawal and exit strategies, but most of it is pretty meaningless, and it will remain so unless we're able to escape the rigid doctrinal constraints that require right-thinking people to reject with horror what everybody in the world takes for granted outside the West, that the U.S. And Britain invaded Iraq because of its enormous energy resources and to gain even greater control over the energy resources of the Middle East, which back as far as 1945, the State Department described as a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. It was also recognized back in the 40s that control over these resources would give Washington veto power over the rest of the industrial world. It was George Kennan, one of the major planners in the late 40s. And that point has recently been reiterated by one of the more astute of contemporary planners, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Wasn't particularly in favor of the invasion of Iraq, but he pointed out that if the U.S. can maintain control over Iraq, it will gain critical leverage over its European and Asian rivals. Well, the U.S. and Britain will surely do everything they can to ensure that Iraq becomes a reliable client state, much like the U.S. dependencies in Central America, or Russia's East European satellites, or for that matter, traditional colonies of the imperial powers. They are typically run by domestic collaborators, domestic security forces, sometimes even with what are called elections, but with the iron fist of the master visibly clenched and ready for use when needed. It's called sovereignty and independence by the masters. Surely what the U.S. and Britain are going to try to achieve in the case of Iraq. There's a prospect that the major source of world energy hydrocarbon resources will be in the hands of a loose Shiite alliance, including Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Shiite Iraq, Shiite Iran, probably with closer links to China already developing, and out of the control of Washington and London. I mean, that would be a nightmare for Washington and London, almost the ultimate nightmare. And unless these considerations are brought to the forefront, talk about exit and withdrawal strategies and also opposition to occupation don't really mean very much. You've got to escape from the iron grip of doctrine even to talk about these things. There's a primary reason why the Non-Proliferation Treaty has collapsed or is facing collapse, and that is the failure of the nuclear states to live up to their own obligations. That's Article 6 of the treaty, which requires the nuclear states, one part of the bargain, to undertake good faith efforts to eliminate nuclear weapons completely. That commitment was underscored by a 1996 World Court decision that they are legally obligated, I'm quoting, to bring to a conclusion negotiations leading to nuclear disarmament in all of its aspects under strict and effective international control. And as long as they refuse, it's unlikely that the bargain will be sustained. Reluctance by one party to fulfill its obligations will breed reluctance in others. All the nuclear states are guilty in this respect, but the U.S. is far in the lead. It's led the pack in its refusal to abide by Article 6 obligations, and for the first time under Bush, it's officially renounced them. It's said that it is no longer bound by Article 6. It's rescinded the unanimous agreement at the year 2000 review conference for an unequivocal undertaking by the nuclear weapon states to accomplish the total elimination of their nuclear arsenals. At the 2005 conference in May, went further. The rejection of the obligation was explicit and clear. At the close of the conference, the U.S. spokesperson went so far as to say that, quoting him, the treaty requires reduction but not elimination of weapons. It's a transparent falsehood, and it wasn't lost on others. Another central part of the NPT compact was the commitment of the nuclear powers to enact and implement a series of other treaties. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was rejected by the Republican Senate in 1999 and was declared off the agenda by Bush. The ABM Treaty, which Bush rescinded. And most important of all is a verifiable FISBAN, Fissile Materials Cutoff Treaty. That's the most important. That would prevent further addition of nuclear bomb material to the already vast amount already existing. In July 2004, Washington announced its firm opposition to any verifiable FISBAN. Nevertheless, in November of 2004, the United Nations took up the issue and had what I think is the most important vote in its history, maybe to the extent that we have future history in any history. In November 2004, the UN did vote in favor of a verifiable fist ban. The vote was 147-1 with two abstentions. Israel, which is reflexive, they must vote with the United States, and Britain. The British ambassador explained his refusal to vote with the overwhelming majority, namely everybody, in favor of fist ban. He said that Britain is in favor of it, but this particular version, he said, has divided the international community. Namely, it divided it 147-1. So therefore, the spear carrier couldn't go along. And that actually gives a lot of insight into the ranking of survival of the species among the priorities of the leadership of the hegemonic power and the pillion passenger and of the media. There was no, in the United States, there was no coverage of this. I have not found any in Europe. And as that continues, for the rest of us, that means we march along, following our leaders, to an Armageddon of our own making, if we choose to do so. There's nothing inevitable about the choice, and it's a choice that has very grim consequences. Thank you.
This was the conclusion of a one-hour talk by Professor Noam Chomsky on the question of survival. He spoke at the University College Dublin, Ireland in January 2006. Professor Chomsky teaches linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and is the author of many books on U.S. foreign policy and the media. You can find more information on Noam Chomsky on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.